weren't like they are now. Our family was poor. We didn't even have a telephone. Ballydonal Hospital was 40 miles away. And there was something else, too. She drew in a deep breath. My brother had lost his only child. His wife was insane with grief. After she attacked him when he insisted that their beloved little girl was gone forever, he could take no more. She had been in and out of psychiatric clinics and the local hospital, but nothing was working. Eventually the doctor sectioned her, and she was taken away. Brandon was advised not to see her for at least a week, maybe longer. He agreed, going so far as to tell them that he didn't want to know anything about Mairead until he chose to visit. He needed time to grieve for his dead daughter. Surely, if she'd run away, they would have told him. Clodagh's lips tightened. The hospital was under scrutiny. They were terrified that if it became known that one of their patients had escaped, they would be closed down. The notes from the local doctors said that she'd run away before but had always returned after a day or two, so they decided to wait and cover it up. In their favour, they were aware that Brendan was also in a fragile state, but when 3 days had passed, they relented and sent a messenger to us with the news. "How soon was she fine?" asked Orak. "She wasn't, my dear. My brother never saw her again. My lovely Brendan died a year later, by his own hand." Now her tears fell freely. How had none of this become common knowledge, Orak wondered. Or had it, and no one had told the O'Dwyers? She remembered from her childhood times when people came together and took a vow of silence. On one occasion, a man was shot dead over some issue connected to the Troubles. Everyone in the village knew who the perpetrator was, but not a soul spoke out. Orak let Clodagh cry for a while, and then she gently asked, "How did you find out what happened?" Dabbing her eyes with the tissue, Clodagh went over to a battered old writing desk. "I received this." She retrieved an envelope and handed it to Orak. "Read it. You may keep it. I'm passing on to you everything I know. The story belongs to you now, Ciara O'Dwyer. Should you ever meet your sister, it will be your decision as to what to do. You see, she has no memory of her early days. She knows nothing of what happened." The well-thumbed letter had obviously been read many times, but Orak doubted its full contents had ever been shared with anyone else. "Dearest Clodagh," it began, "please don't hate me for this. Try to find it in your heart to forgive me." Orak struggled to read it. The account was written in graphic detail, as precise as some of the police reports that had come her way. Finally, she folded the letter and said to Clodagh, "She overcame her mental distress enough to look after Grania and care for her. The child wanted for nothing. Mairead had an old friend in Dublin, a wealthy man who was in love with her. She went to him for help, and he saw your sister through school and university."
"And ask no questions?" Orak said.
"He believed she was Mairead's daughter, and that Mairead had fled an abusive marriage. He looked no further." Clodagh paused. "Or maybe he didn't wish to. He had what he'd always wanted, the woman he loved. And meanwhile our family suffered. I'm still suffering to this day. It changed my parents forever. They resented me and my brothers to such an extent that we left home as soon as we could. Has she no idea what she's done? How many lives she's ruined?"
"Had no idea. Mairead is dead, Ciara. We met just the once. The letter doesn't mention how she changed Grania's name by deed, Paul, because she wanted to free her daughter from her past. But that is something I must leave with you. As I said, it's your decision."
"You saw her? Grania?" Orak hadn't noticed that Clodagh was holding something besides the letter. She handed it to her. Orak found herself looking at the photo of a young woman with dark hair and deep blue eyes beneath perfectly arched eyebrows.
"Grania," she whispered. "She's called Louisa now. Louisa Kennedy."
Orak swallowed hard.
"I saw her 3 times in all, once at Mairead's funeral, then twice after that, on the anniversary of her death. Claude sighed. It wasn't easy, lying to her, swallowing my words whenever she called Mairead her loving mother. That's why I lost touch with her after she moved on.
Mairead died quite young, didn't she? Another suicide?
No. Cancer.
Clodagh sat back into her chair and shook her head.
You'll have some soul-searching to do, Kira. Your sister has forged a life for herself. She is happy, content in the belief that her mother and her benefactor did their very best for her.
She looked at Orak intently.
I hope you won't make a decision that will hurt your sister.
Clodagh was right. She did need to examine her conscience. Orak exhaled.
Nevertheless, I have to find her. After that, I don't know. I don't want to hurt her, but I do believe that some things should not be kept hidden. Secrets and lies fester, and the poison always finds its way to the surface eventually.
I'm proof of that, said the old lady bitterly. Orak saw that she was growing tired.
I should go, but there's one last thing, if it's not too much to ask.
Clodagh smiled wearily.
You want the address in Dublin, don't you? The place where she grew up.
Please. Did Mairead tell you anything else that might help me find Grania?
I will give you the address, but I can't help you further. If nothing else, you know she isn't dead.
Orak wondered how many times she had relived that moment, waking and finding an empty bed, searching, calling her name, running to their parents. Mairead had ripped the heart out of her family, destroyed it, and left it broken. One of her brothers had taken to drugs. The other went to America and never came back. And Kira? There was no Kira after that. She shook herself and mustered a smile for the old woman.
Thank you for telling me all this. I can't tell you how relieved I am that my sister is alive and happy.
They both stood up. Clodagh O'Leary wrote down the Dublin address and handed it to her.
The man's name is Wilson Flaherty. He's a good man, Kira.
I don't doubt it. Orak paused at the door. Clodagh, if anyone should ask, I was never here. You aren't the only one with secrets. None of this will go any farther, and I don't exist, okay?
Chapter 16. By the time Marie got back to the station, she had convinced herself that the young explorers had been killed because of a place they had visited, rather than something they had done. She was very interested to hear what Lisa and Will Sheringham would have to say when she and Robbie met them the following day. It was practically time to go home, and as far as she knew, Jackman had been ensconced in his office the entire day. Then she saw his door open, and hands being shook. The two Met detectives were finally taking their leave. Jackman looked exhausted.
"Done and dusted?" she asked him.
He ran a hand through his hair.
"Plenty of loose ends to tie up, but with the help of Berry, our new office manager, we've pretty well nailed it. I should think there's smoke coming from the photocopier. Bit of a baptism of fire for poor Berry, but she's been a star."
He smiled at her.
"From what they've told me, our friend Kirby could be looking at a very long stretch indeed."
"Music to my ears," said Marie. "Then you can help us with our Urbex problem."
She told him about the parcels of clothes that had been delivered to Rory.
"Why on earth do that?" he asked.
"It had a kind of finality to it, rather like what you said about tying up loose ends."
"That certainly indicates that he has killed them," said Jackman soberly.
"I said that too," said Marie, "but the prof suggested that they might have been made to ditch all of their own things in favor of some kind of uniform, like in a cult."
"Sadly, I think my idea is going to prove to be the right one," Jackman said, yawning. "I'm telling you, I get more tired sitting in an office dealing with paperwork than I ever do racing around chasing villains. I wouldn't want the super's job, however much they paid me."
"Me neither," said Marie with feeling. "You look done in. Gonna get you a coffee? Then I suggest you go home."
"Yes, to both of those. A coffee would be great while I clear my desk, and then I'm going home to soak in a hot bath."
"Glad to hear it, boss. Start afresh tomorrow. Let's just hope no one goes missing tonight.
Apparently there's a warning been posted on all the local Urbex sites telling people to back off for a while. Stella doesn't think they'll take any notice, but it might deter a few.
We can only hope.
Marie got Jackman's coffee and took it to his office. Turning to go, she said,
Oh God, I wish Orak was here.
That sounded heartfelt, Marie.
She clicked her tongue. I keep thinking that if she were here, she'd be able to work out the connection between our Mispers.
Have you heard from her again?
No.
And I can't stop thinking about it, wondering if she's safe. She won't be able to stay under the radar for long, Jackman. The people that are after her are far from stupid.
And they have serious resources at their disposal.
He stared into his coffee.
She's worrying me too, Marie. I can't help thinking of how vulnerable she is with her injury.
Me too. If only she were here.
Marie leaned against his desk. But in her absence, what do you think about asking Leon and the rest of the team to try and run a search on our missing Urbexes? Maybe they can come up with something Max can't. I'm not knocking his computer skills, but they're experts. Orak herself chose them, so they have to be the best.
Jackman nodded. Go and see Leon in the morning. It's certainly worth a try.
She straightened up. Good, I'll do that. Now, I'll let you get on, and anyway, I've got a date.
Jackman's eyes widened. Yeah? Really?
With one of Gary's steak and ale pies, actually, so don't be jealous. She grinned broadly at him.
Actually, I am jealous. I've sampled those before. Oh, well.
Enjoy. I will. Good night, sir. See you tomorrow. Nightfall across the fens.
Alone in her flat, Callie Protheroe glanced at the window and swore. Normally on a night like this, she would be preparing to go out on an exploration. As it was, she was lying on her sofa, flicking listlessly through the TV channels and finding nothing to interest her. She stood up, went to the kitchen and opened the fridge. She had already eaten her supper, but boredom always gave her the munchies. She took out a cold quiche and bit into it, hating herself for giving in to temptation. She closed the fridge door quickly. Her near miss at the hotel had shaken her badly, and young Grant Leach's abduction from the very same place had only compounded it. Now she was angry, as well as scared. Apart from anything else, this maniac had stopped her from doing what she most loved. To make it worse, she had a gem of a place lined up to investigate, and instead, here she was, channel-hopping and fridge-raiding. Callie paced the room. Maybe she should just go out. This strange vendetta against urban explorers had nothing to do with her, did it? It couldn't have, or he would have taken her when he had the chance. No, this was something personal between him and the particular men he'd abducted. Then she remembered the serious faces of those two detectives. Supposing she ignored their warnings and something happened to her. What to do? Her phone rang.
Jimmy, I'm so glad you called. I'm going quietly nuts here. I feel like I'm under curfew.
Jimmy Cook, a Scot, was one of two fellow Urbexes who she did occasionally go out with. He was an experienced explorer and a very good photographer. His expeditions usually had her climbing towers or shinning up onto high roofs.
Well, you probably won't be surprised to hear that Hugh and I have decided not to comply.
He gave a throaty laugh.
Let's face it, what are the odds of running into this fruitcake? He can't be everywhere at once, can he? And that brings me to the purpose of this call.
Callie's stomach tightened in anticipation.
After hearing about your close call, we reckon lightning doesn't strike twice, so you'd be a pretty safe bet to go out with. We've been listening to some interesting stuff on the grapevine.
Ah, so this is entirely for your own benefit. You want to take me along as your lucky talisman?
Of course,
he laughed again.
Actually, Callie, we know you pretty well, and Hughie reckoned you might be going stir-crazy, but don't fancy going solo until this lunatic has been caught. Is he right?
Hughie was Jimmy's younger brother, a gentle, quiet lad with an encyclopedic knowledge of church architecture. Visiting an abandoned or deconsecrated church or chapel with Hughie was an education.
Shall I get my boots out, then?
Perfect. Now, we have a couple of suggestions, unless you have somewhere in particular that you're itching to infiltrate. For a moment she hesitated. The place she had been thinking about earlier was supposed to be something really special that she had planned on keeping to herself. On the other hand, it could be ages before she felt like going out alone again.
Well, as it happens...
Tell us more, Jimmy said excitedly.
Callie hoped she wouldn't regret sharing it, but she really wanted to see this place. Plus, she liked and trusted the Cook brothers, and was grateful to them for asking her.
I think this could be right up your brother's street, said Callie, but we need to get out to Hallow's Fen.
What on earth could be out there, Cal?
Jimmy sounded puzzled.
Ah, it's one of those droves that wanders off into acres of fields, with a scattering of cottages and barns and nothing but long stretches of road between each.
So? What's out there to interest us? Jimmy asked.
Our final destination appears to be a cluster of old trees. She paused.
Until you look closer.
You drive across a rickety bridge over a deep water-filled drain, and on the other side is an old driveway.
And? Stop teasing, tell us! Jimmy exclaimed.
An old church, she said smugly. Part ruined, part intact. And as far as I know, unexplored. She heard Huey, listening on speaker, give a whoop of delight. The thing is, apart from a few old locals, no one knows it's there. The trees obscure it on one side, and then there's nothing. Even walkers don't use that section of the sea bank. You wouldn't even see it from a boat. As the sea defences are higher than the fields, it's a gem, lads, an unexplored gem. Jimmy whistled softly.
Speaking of gems, Kelly Prothero, you're a diamond.
He hesitated.
But don't we need to scout it out in daylight?
It sounds like we'll need a whole lot of lights if we go tonight. There's no moon and there's heavy cloud cover forecast for the night.
The light shouldn't be a problem. I've researched the farmland and it's leased. No one lives anywhere near the place and the trees would mask the lights from the road.
She'd done her homework, believing that she would be alone out there.
And it's remarkably easy to access. The drive is still intact. Any graves must have been removed when the church was deconsecrated. And although you'd need to go careful in the ruined part, the body of the old place has been well protected by the trees. It's perfectly possible to go there at night.
Well, from the look on little brother's face, I reckon you should get those boots out right now. Shall we pick you up?
Callie thankfully switched off the TV.
Give me 30 minutes, and bring as many powerful torches as you can. We are going exploring.
At around 10 o'clock, Aurac called Marie, who had just got home from Gary's. She was putting her Triumph in the garage when she heard her new phone ring.
I need to talk, Marie. Is it a bad time?
Marie heaved a sigh of relief.
It's perfect, Aurac. I was just about to chill out for half an hour before turning in, so I have all the time in the world.
Aurac laughed.
Just as well.
She paused briefly.
I found her, Marie. Well, not exactly. But after all these years, I know what happened to my sister.
My God, that's wonderful, she added doubtfully.
I hope.
Oh, it's wonderful, all right.
Marie went into her tiny conservatory and flopped down into a rattan armchair.
Tell me everything.
Aurac repeated what Clodagh had told her and emitted a loud sigh.
No, I have so many questions going around in my head. I mean, how could Marie's family allow ours to suffer all those years, knowing that little Grania hadn't been murdered but taken by a woman deranged by grief over the loss of her own child? It was inhumane. If we had been told, maybe we would still be a family, not a disconnected group of lonely, angry misfits.
Marie said nothing, not knowing how to respond.
And now I am torn apart. I don't know what to do next.
I suppose you have two choices. Track her down, reassure yourself that she's as happy as your Clodagh says she is,
then walk away. Or find her and tell her the truth about herself.
Marie was far from certain which of those two options she would choose.
That's difficult enough, but there's another dilemma. My parents believe I went missing on duty. They really need to be told about Grania. But how on earth do I go about that, when they believe I'm dead?
Good point.
And of course, if they think she's still alive, they'll be desperate to see her, talk to her, have her back.
Marie sighed.
And God knows what that would do to your sister's mental health. As I said, so many questions.
Aurac sounded on the verge of tears.
Can I make a suggestion?
Oh, please do, Marie.
Why not go to Dublin? Speak to this man who was her benefactor. Tell him you're a friend who has lost touch and see if you can find her. See your sister in the flesh.
but don't attempt to speak with her. Then come home, give yourself time to make a considered decision, and then do whatever you decide to be right. Marie paused. You are far too close to it out there to make a rational decision, and if you don't want to speak to that man, you have your sister's new name, so you can track her electronically. If anyone can find her, you can. But first, come home to Sultan Le Fen.
Where's words, Marie? I'll sleep on them and ring you again tomorrow.
I have to move away from here in any case. I'm not certain, but there might be someone watching me. I'm safe for tonight. I wasn't followed here. But I need to get well away by morning.
Marie grew frightened again.
Come home, Orak, please.
Don't worry, my dear. We'll talk tomorrow, I promise.
And thank you for listening, I appreciate it.
I'm always here any time, day or night. Just stay safe and for God's sake, get yourself back where you belong.
Marie lay awake for a long time that night, pondering the decision that Orak had to make. On the surface, the most wonderful thing had happened. Her sister was alive and well, and to all intents and purposes, a happy, well-balanced woman. But whatever Orak chose to do, someone would get hurt. Marie believed in speaking the truth, but what if that truth damaged someone? Do you steal someone's faith in the mother who loved and cherished them? Do you destroy their precious memories? Or do you let them live a lie? Tossing and turning, Marie began to think that there were no perfect answers. It would all boil down to what Orak's conscience determined. She hadn't asked Orak where she was, because Orak couldn't tell her. It would be too risky. Marie's heart went out to her, alone somewhere, and confused, not knowing the right thing to do. And on top of all that, someone might be watching her.
Chapter 17. Hallow's Fen was a nowhere place. There was no village, no signpost, no visible boundaries, just fields and ditches and dikes, and the occasional cluster of wind-blown trees, weathered barn or run-down cottage. It gave new meaning to the word bleak.
"Not quite a tourist attraction, is it?"
commented Hughie as they drove across the endless dark fields.
"You may not believe it, but it's even worse in daylight," said Callie. "At night you can imagine that there are other things out here that you just can't see. In the daytime it's all out in the open, a big expanse of nothing."
"Except a possibly virgin exploration site," said Jimmy. "How long ago did you find this place?"
Callie thought about it. "Probably around 4 weeks ago. I'd already found the hotel at Fleet Sea's End and decided that it was more likely to be discovered by other explorers, so I researched that first."
"How come you find all these fresh sites?" asked Jimmy. "I thought we'd well exhausted this area, and then you turn up too, one after the other."
"I'm just nosy, I guess," she smiled. "And I have a knack for finding things by accident. Both these sites were the result of either getting lost or ending up somewhere by mistake." She stared ahead into the darkness. "Slow down a bit, Jimmy. We're almost there."
In minutes, they were crunching their way slowly down the overgrown drive to the church.
"I see what you mean about being well concealed from the road."
Hughie looked at the surrounding trees illuminated in the headlights.
"Although I'd have noticed these old trees. They've always featured in churchyards. Still are. Look, that beautiful old yew must be really old. And as the draining of the fens was begun back in the 1500s, but only really implemented in 1631, the church would have been built when the first habitable village emerged around that time."
"Oh, Lord, he's off," grumbled Jimmy. "Professor Hughie takes the floor."
"Piss off," said his brother amiably. "This is exciting."
"Right, let's get organized." Callie stepped out of the car into the cold night air. A wind was blowing in off the wash, and she shivered. Now it came to it. She was very relieved not to have attempted this bimble alone. Having the lads with her made it so much more enjoyable. Even so, she had adhered to her normal routine and had rung Henry Arnott to let him know where she was going. He surprised her by saying that he knew the place. He had been there many years ago, while he was working for the local council as a surveyor. If anything went wrong, Henry would know where they were. They took all their gear from the car boot and headed off towards a set of rusted wrought iron gates and a dilapidated lich gate. The place looked eerie in torchlight.
like somewhere from Tales from the Crypt.
Jimmy started making soft woo-woo noises, trying to be either a ghost or an owl, not very convincing. Then they saw the church.
"Oh my," breathed Huey. "I was wrong. This is much, much older."
"How come? Well, this is supposed to be reclaimed land," asked Callie.
"Oh, there are hundreds of really old churches right across the county. There were settlements on slightly higher islands that remained dry when the lower marshy areas of the Fenlands flooded. The church at Algakirk, close to the Wash, it's 12th century. Lincolnshire has the finest collection of medieval churches in the country. Travellers used to navigate the flat landscape by the different church spires and towers."
He stared up at the old church.
"This would have been a lovely old church. I wonder what happened to it."
Part of it, mostly one end of the nave and the chancel, was in ruins, but the tower, a two-tier construction, was intact.
"It wasn't very clear," said Callie, "but I think this area took several hits during the Second World War."
"That's quite possible. They did target the docks and the port on this part of the East Coast," said Jimmy, "which is not far along the Wash from here, and they used to dump the remaining bombs if a mission didn't go to plan, or if they'd taken a hit and had to limp home."
"This place is a bit like that hotel, Eastfleet Manor. It's in two halves. There it was fire damage, here it looks like a bomb, but in both cases some of the structure still stands."
The similarity between the two brought back some of the fear she had experienced in the old hotel.
"I can't wait to see inside," said Huey eagerly.
"Then let's go."
Jimmy started forward, then stopped.
"You lead the way, Callie. It's your place."
He squeezed her arm. Huey was right. This was exciting. She wasn't going to let one bad experience ruin all her other explores.
"Okay, follow me. There's a door at the back that has rotted, and the lock and latch have fallen off. We turn right inside, or we finish up in the ruin, and that's too dangerous. We want to see the two remaining side chapels and the tower."
Callie stepped forward.
"There is remarkably little overgrowth on the pathway, so it's pretty easy to navigate, but the trees around the tower are massive, and there are one or two of the branches down, so watch your step."
Soon, they were inside. Huey directed the beam of his powerful torch around the ceiling and sighed with delight.
"Beautiful! Just beautiful!"
"What's left of it?" said Jimmy,
down to earth as ever. Some lovely plasterwork remained, some decorative ribs and bosses, but sadly, much had been lost.
"The chapels are intact," Callie said, "and it looks like the tower has survived remarkably well."
Jimmy looked first at the part that was in ruins, and then back.
"The font looks as if it's waiting for the next baby. Now that's really nice."
"Let's get some pictures," said Huey. "There are some glorious shots just waiting to be taken. I mean, look at that statue of Christ. It's perfect, silhouetted against all that bomb damage. It's really evocative. Could be a winner of an image."
Callie had already seen it. She'd got her camera out and was wondering how best to set up some lighting.
"What if we uplit it, put a light source below it, shining upwards, but out of the picture?"
They all had a variety of torches with them, along with battery-powered searchlights and LED construction lamps for floodlighting.
"Yeah, good idea, Callie. And maybe do a really low-lit one with just candles all around the base. That would emphasize the religious feel of it."
Huey grinned at her. "Let's play."
Callie pulled a lamp from her rucksack. It was great to have these two with her. For a while, especially after her session in that interview room with the two detectives, she had wondered if she would ever go out again. Thank heavens Jimmy had called her. They got several shots that they both had high hopes for. Callie was itching to see them on the computer screen. One in particular had amazing contrast of light and shadow, and could be Huey's predicted winner of an image.
"I'm just going to see if the tower's accessible,"
called out Jimmy from the font area.
"The stairs probably go up from behind this door."
"Wait for us," called Callie. "Best not to go alone. It could be dangerous. I didn't check that out when I came before. I think the door was either locked or jammed."
She picked up her torches and the LED lamp and went down to where Jimmy was trying the heavy old wooden door.
"It's just stiff, I think. There's no key in the lock and..."
He stopped.
"Well, if you didn't open it, somebody else certainly has. Look."
He pointed to a curved mark in the dirt on the floor, where the door had swung back and scraped across the stone slabs. Callie thought back to when she had come here in the daylight. There had been no footprints, and certainly no scuff marks on the floor. This was recent.
"No matter," said Hughie optimistically. "Even if another clan have been here, I bet our pictures will knock spots off theirs, eh, Callie? I swear we've got a couple of gems with that statue."
Callie began to feel apprehensive. She told herself that Hughie was probably right about it being another group of Urbexes. But what if it wasn't?
"Happens all the time, doesn't it?" said Jimmy. "The main thing is that we've never seen this place before, and it's pretty awesome. If I can get up the tower, I'll be as happy as a pig in shit, believe me."
She laughed. "Pig in chiffon? Please yourself, but I know which one the pig would prefer." He lifted and pulled, and the door swung back. In front of them was a flight of spiral stone steps, their surface indented and worn away by the countless feet that had trudged up there over hundreds of years. She wasn't a great fan of heights. In fact, she preferred underground spaces, but she wasn't going to let a fellow Urbexer go off alone when they hadn't done a recce in daylight. She followed him up the stairs. Jimmy was light on his feet and took the steps rapidly. Callie was more cautious. She could hear Hughie behind her, which was slightly reassuring, but she couldn't help wondering if the previous visitor had been the man who had abducted the other Urbexers. As she climbed, she started to make unpleasant connections in her mind. He had been at East Fleet Manor the night she had gone there. He returned the next night and took one of the other explorers. What if he had been here, in Hallow's Fen Church last night? Did that mean he was planning on taking one of them tonight? Her mouth went dry.
"Jimmy? Hughie, I'm not sure we should go up there. This doesn't feel right."
She tried to keep the panic out of her voice, but she wasn't being very successful.
"It's okay, Callie," called back Jimmy. "I'm just about to go into the Bellringer's loft. I'm sure there's no one in there, so relax."
"And I'm right behind," called up Hughie. "No one's following me. And for future reference, bro, it's called a ringing chamber, not a bloody loft."
His banter calmed Callie somewhat. She was starting to understand that she had been more deeply disturbed by her encounter with the stalker than she'd realized. She reached the top step and went into the stone chamber with Hughie a few steps behind her.
"Can't wait to see the chamber," Hughie panted. "Those rooms are so cool. You often find fascinating memorabilia left by ringers of long ago. They used to have rhymes, or sometimes you find lists of the captains, the head bell ringers, from centuries gone by."
"Jesus, this place stinks," called out Jimmy. "Must be dead rats or something. Hold your noses when you come in."
Callie and Hughie went in together.
"Ugh, that's terrible," gasped Hughie.
He shone his torch across the floor.
"And what's all that muck where the ringers would have stood?"
Trying not to gag, Callie looked and saw a mess of dark liquid and some sort of glutinous substance covering the central area of the small tower room.
"Maybe some big bud of prey got trapped in here and died," said Jimmy. "I wanted to get to the top of the tower, but I'm sure not walking across that lot."
Callie began to retch.
"I have to go down again. Sorry, boys, but this is gross." "Let's just see if the bells are still in situ," said Hughie. "Then we'll all get out of here."
They all shone their torches up into the tower, where the bell frames were housed. Callie screamed. The shock of what she saw kept her riveted to the spot, and although all she wanted to do was run, she could not drag her eyes from the scene above. Three bell ropes still dangled loosely into the chamber, but high above them, on the remaining ones, swung three decaying bodies.
"Oh my God!"
Jimmy took charge, shepherding Callie and Hughie back through the door to the spiral staircase.
"Out of here, now. But don't panic, or you might fall. Just get back down the stairs as carefully as possible."
They needed no second telling. Hughie went first, making sure that Callie was close behind him. Then Jimmy closed the door on the nightmare scene and followed them. At the bottom of the staircase, they paused to get their breath back and take a lungful of cleaner air. Then they grabbed their things and ran from the church.
We get away from here, called out Jimmy, fumbling with the car keys. As fast as possible, then we call the police.
They threw their equipment into the car and clambered in.
Just go, said Huey, his voice shaking.
Callie was silent, certain that the picture burnt into her memory would never go away. Three bodies, all suspended upside down, secured to the bell rope by one leg. In the torchlight, it had seemed as if they were swaying grotesquely, arms hanging down, dead hands reaching out towards her.
You okay, Callie?
Huey put an arm around her. She wasn't, but she couldn't tell him. She couldn't say anything.
Jim, she's in shock. I'm calling an ambulance.
She heard him clearly enough, but was unable to respond. It felt as if she were trapped back in that room, in the darkness and the stench and the silence. She felt the car pull to a halt and heard Huey talking to the emergency services, asking for both police and an ambulance, and as quickly as possible. She thought vaguely. Probably a good idea.
Chapter 18.
Navigating the hazardous fen lanes towards little-known Hallows Fen, Jackman saw a single rear light somewhere ahead of him and smiled.
Marie. She would be in her element. She loved night riding. The more difficult, the better.
Lanes like these were bad enough in daylight, but Marie, on her Triumph Tiger, took every bend and curve with all the skill of an accomplished rider. It frightened the hell out of him, but she reveled in it. The call had come in at around midnight, and they had little idea of what they'd find at the scene. The only solid fact was that three Urbexes had defied the warning to stay away from abandoned buildings and had been badly frightened. Apparently one of them was in a bad way, so whatever had happened must have been traumatic. The young man who phoned it in had been almost sobbing. He kept talking about bodies, hung up somewhere. Bodies, he had said. Not a body. Jackman slowed to negotiate a sudden double bend, then pulled away onto the long straight stretch of road that led to Hallows Fen. He had been here only once before. It was that kind of place. He had been on traffic duty during his days in uniform and had been chasing a joyrider in a stolen car. The young driver had made the mistake of swinging off the main road thinking he could lose the police on the back doubles, unaware that the road to Hallows Fen led to a dead end. It nearly had been a dead end, too, as the kid had lost control of the car and spun off the lane into a deep drainage ditch. Jackman had pulled him out unconscious while the stolen car slowly filled with muddy water. Ahead, he saw a small collection of flashing blue lights. The single brake light came on, and the motorcycle pulled off the road. Jackman frowned. He didn't recall having seen any buildings on his one and only visit to this desolate spot. He pulled in behind a police car and an ambulance and got out. He saw Marie wearing full leathers, carrying her helmet under her arm and toting a small backpack over her shoulder. Behind her were two uniformed officers and a paramedic, all talking to two young men. From the way they were dressed, Jackman knew that these were the urban explorers. So where was the third?
Evening, sir? Or should I say morning?
Marie sounded remarkably bright. He gave her a wry smile.
Another rude awakening, eh? So, what have we got?
Three Urbexes, or whatever you call them, were exploring an old church just up ahead. According to them, they've made a rather unpleasant discovery, but Uniform have waited for us before going in.
Thoughtful of them, muttered Jackman.
If what these kids say is true, we have a major crime scene, sir, Marie said. Possibly three dead. She raised an eyebrow. His heart sank.
Ah, and we have three missing explorers, don't we?
Exactly. That's why our presence was requested and why they waited for us. In the harsh light of the vehicles, the two young men looked like pale ghosts.
Where's the third?
Marie pulled a face. The third one, sir, is Callie Prothero. I don't know if you remember, but she was the woman who came forward after being followed at that ruined hotel, Eastfleet Manor.
The third abduction site?
Asked Jackman, who was out of the loop, having been occupied with the Kirby case.
That's right, boss. She's in deep shock. Whatever they saw, it scared the shit out of her. She's not speaking. Hasn't spoken since they found the bodies, apparently.
and the medics are getting ready to take her to Greenbridge General.
Not Salton?
They are really worried about her, sir. Greenborough has better facilities for psychiatric care, including an excellent on-call psychologist, as I recall.
Laura?
Laura, I suspect you won't be the only occupant of Mill Corner whose sleep is disturbed tonight. Well, I guess we shouldn't hang around. Ready?
He hoped so. After everything he'd seen of late, he had been looking forward to slightly less traumatic times, but it seemed that wasn't to be. Soon, they were making their way down an old weed-covered gravel drive. They found themselves staring into a thick cluster of giant trees, lit up in the beam of their torches. A single police vehicle was parked in front of a dilapidated lich gate. Jackman frowned.
So was the bloody church.
One of the constables, carrying a powerful flashlight, came towards them.
Let me go ahead, sir. I've got a better torch. Lizzie's just fetching a couple of halogen lamps from the car. We've taken a brief look at the entry point, but not having coveralls, we didn't want to compromise the scene.
It could be nothing. Even some sort of scam. But looking at the faces of those two Urbexes, I fear the worst. What do you think, Marie?
Me too, she said. She reached inside her backpack and produced two plastic bags. I brought these just in case.
She handed him a protective coverall.
Or we can wait for a soccer. He took a package and tore it open.
No time like the present, and frankly, this is our responsibility.
They followed the constable further along the drive and around the dark, brooding church to the back door.
Then, in their zoot suits and shoe covers, and with two powerful lamps, they went in.
You'd think we'd be used to this by now, wouldn't you? Whispered Marie.
Not me, said Jackman grimly. Every time I try to prepare myself, and then we walk into something totally unimaginable.
Maybe that won't be the case this time. This was said without much conviction. Both were thinking of Callie Prothero, a seasoned explorer who wasn't afraid to enter abandoned buildings alone at night, now crouched in the back of an ambulance, unable to utter a word. Jackman went first. He was only halfway up when the smell hit him. It was unmistakable. He stepped inside the bell ringer's chamber and steeled himself. He switched on the powerful light, gazed up into the illuminated area, and froze. His initial reaction was to stop Marie from entering, but he was too late. She was already at his shoulder. He felt her stiffen, then step back. Now he knew why Callie Prothero was in the state she was. Marie laid a hand on his arm. Jackman cleared his throat.
I suppose we should try to make some kind of sense of what we're looking at.
The work of a bloody maniac is all that comes to mind right now, Marie said through gritted teeth. Hard to see past that, isn't it? God, that stench! She coughed and said in a monotone, Three bodies, each suspended by their left ankle from bell ropes. One appears to have been here considerably longer than the others. One not quite as long, and one very recent.
Little doubt we're looking at our missing explorers, is there?
Jackman said.
Hard to tell from down here, but they all appear to be male.
And all dressed in the same outfit, Marie squinted. I wonder why. What that means.
Jackman had noticed it too, but what it meant could be dealt with later. We've seen enough, Marie. It's time to ring it in.
We need to get everything we can with this one. Forensics, the fire service to get them down, and a truck full of coppers to secure the site. I just hope everyone involved has a bloody strong stomach, Marie added. This is beyond madness. Jackman swung the halogen beam away from the three dead men, committing them back to the dark.
Let's go. We need to get those poor sods out of this hellhole as soon as possible.
Making his way back down the spiral staircase, Jackman mused on the awful sight the police confronted almost daily in the course of their working lives. Horrific road traffic accidents, drownings, drug overdoses, burnt bodies. The list was endless. You could cope with those. Life was tough, and such things happened. But cruelty, torture deliberately inflicted on another human being, that was horror of a different order. How did you cope then?
The relief at being out of there, breathing in cold, fresh night air, was incredible.
The two constables waiting outside looked into their faces and made no comment. They didn't need to.
Finally, the constable called Lizzie said quietly, "We'll organize setting up a crime scene lock, sir. You'll be arranging everything else."
Jackman nodded. "And Lizzie, no one at all is to set foot in there until I say so. Is that understood?"
"Completely, sir. We'll get our side underway immediately."
He was glad she hadn't asked any questions. He glanced at Marie. "You okay?" She rolled her eyes.
"Just when I thought Sultan the Fen had finally got back to normal, this happens. I'm beginning to wonder what normal is."
He sighed. "Wouldn't it be nice to get a simple crime of passion? Husband finds wife in arms of another man and flips. Or a drug dealer that gets taken out by someone he shortchanged. Something straightforward, you know?"
"And something that doesn't tattoo your brain with horrifying images," she echoed his sigh. "I'm thinking of those kids who walked in on this totally unprepared. They're going to need professional help, all of them, not just Callie. I know what I feel like, and I'm an experienced copper."
Glad to be putting that ruined tower behind them for a while, they walked quickly back towards the vehicles. "I'll set the wheels in motion for this circus, Murray. Would you go and talk to the two lads? Maybe try to gauge how they're reacting."
"Of course," said Marie, "and I'll make sure they understand the importance of accepting as much help as they can get at this early stage. I know what macho young men can be like, but I'll get the point across."
In her boots and motorcycle leathers, Marie certainly looked persuasive. "If this Amazon told you black was white, you'd seriously consider the possibility." Jackman watched Marie settle the two young men in the back of the patrol car, and then returned to his own vehicle to set the official wheels in motion. He must inform the super, but would get all the basic practical stuff out of the way first, which would take a while. The least he could do was let Ruth have another hour's rest before he dropped this one in her lap. Stella had not been sleeping well. It might have been something to do with her pregnancy, but she guessed it was more likely to be worry over the missing Urbexes. At 2 in the morning, she got up and went down to the kitchen to make tea. As she waited for the kettle to boil, she tried to fathom why on earth anyone would bear a grudge against urban exploration. It didn't make sense. They weren't vandals. It was they who cared. They cared about the fading past, the beautiful buildings left to rot, their history, and all the things they had meant to people in their day. All they did was take photographs to preserve what would soon be lost. Where was the harm in that?
"Can't sleep again, sweetheart."
Tom was standing in the doorway, pulling his dressing gown around him and yawning.
"Oh, I'm so sorry, Tom. I didn't mean to wake you. You have to get up so early. Go back to bed."
"I missed the chance of a brew, no way." He sat down opposite her. "To be honest, I'm not sleeping well either. I keep thinking about the disappearances. I feel so helpless, knowing that I can't come up with some valid explanation for them."
"Me too, babe. And maybe because of all my years in the police and some of the things I saw, I have a terrible feeling this is going to end badly."
Stella took 2 mugs from the cupboard.
"I feel helpless too."
Tom sighed. "What worries me is how many more kids are going to go missing before the police find this maniac. That's not meant to be disrespectful to your mate Robbie or the police, but where do you start when you have no known motive and no clue as to where he'll strike next?"
"Oh, they'll get him, sweetheart. I have no doubt about that. The killer will either make a mistake, or they'll find some piece of evidence, or maybe a witness will come forward. And Robbie won't let this one drop, believe me. He's a damn good detective, and the team he is with now are the best."
She placed the mug of tea in front of her husband.
"But you're right. How many more will he attack before he's taken down?"
"I keep wanting to ring all our friends just to make sure they're safe, but I can't keep bothering them. They've been warned off, so hopefully they'll have the sense to stay away from exploring for a while, or go way out of the area." He held his hands around his mug. "Razor was telling me that a couple of groups have gone to Belgium for a few days to explore some of the old chateau there, just to be completely on the safe side."
"Don't blame them."
Stella sat down again.
"I doubt he'll follow them that far."
Tom frowned. "Unless he's targeting particular individuals." Stella frowned.
"I still think it's unlikely he'll stray too far away from where he's comfortable. After all, he has to have a plan of how to get his targets away from the abduction site,
and as they are possibly unconscious, they'd be a dead weight, and he will most certainly have a destination in mind for where he's taking them. So, no, babe, he won't be chasing Urbexes to foreign shores. He'll stay on his own patch, I'm certain of it.
Once a copper, always a copper. You sound just like you used to.
Tom smiled at her, reached out and took her hand.
I hope being a farmer's wife isn't too boring for you still.
She shook her head. I couldn't be happier. That was another life. I'll help Robbie all I can, simply because it's our friends that are being targeted. But from the comfort of our own home, okay? No wild escapades. And anyway, she patted her belly. We have something very special to concentrate on, don't we?
We certainly do. Now, my beautiful woman, you need your rest. Let's go back to bed and take the tea with us.
But an hour later, while Tom snored peacefully, Stella still lay awake. There had to be more she could do. Urban exploration was something she understood better than the police, and it was her community that was being terrorized. Surely she was better placed than they to find that missing motive. She closed her eyes and started drawing up a mental list of people to talk to. Okay, there would be no wild escapades, but a bit of undercover sleuthing was a different matter, wasn't it?
Chapter 19.
Aura cuddled in her sleeping bag. The wind was blowing in off the sea, hammering at the deserted cottage on the edge of the ghost village. In the distance, she could hear the waves crashing onto the shore. In her early days as an active agent, she had been fearless out in the field. This was what she was born to do. Now, however, some years older, and suffering a serious disability, she felt vulnerable. She had done things that the other side would never forgive, intercepting and stealing crucial information that had proved vital to British security. She would never be truly safe, but especially out here, alone, in a very remote spot, the odds were piled high against her. Over the years, she had managed to compensate for her monocular vision. She had found ways to adjust to the change in depth perception and the more restricted field of vision. But it was still a disability, and apart from the frustration and the anger it caused her, it had made her aware of her more limited capabilities. It was telling her now that this must be her last night in the cottage. During the previous day, she had noticed several small incidents that had given her cause for concern, minor occurrences, but nonetheless there were things she couldn't dismiss. For one, she had noticed the same car in two different locations. That alone was enough to worry her. She would leave at first light, possibly earlier. She shifted uncomfortably in her thermal sleeping bag. She needed to sleep, but her mind was too active. Being in Ireland again had stirred up old memories, and her solitary state had brought flashbacks to her time as an agent. From an early age, Aurek had been aware of her natural ability to understand the workings of technology. She wasn't the only one to recognize it. A perceptive teacher had spotted her potential and had brought it to the attention of the school headmistress. Soon she found herself separated from her schoolmates and given one-on-one tutoring. She was often sent on IT courses, and the results of tests set her, and at which she excelled, were subjected to close scrutiny. Without realizing it, she had been selected and was being groomed by a shadowy department within the government, destined for a very particular role in national security. Then she met her nemesis, a man who finally ended her stellar career when he plunged a stiletto into her eye. Her fellow agent, Dara Quinn, had overpowered him and gone on to save her life and part of her sight by getting her medical attention in the nick of time. It was Dara, too, who had given her the lead to Grania, so she was doubly indebted to him. Dara and she had been close. They worked perfectly together as a team, and Aurek was certain that even if they never met again, they would always remain close. You don't put your life in someone's hands and then forget them. It had been Dara's job to get her, the brains who did the clever stuff, in and out of some very dangerous situations and keep her safe. Until they met the Evil One, as people called him, and found themselves betrayed.
Dara had been devastated when she stood down, and for a while she had worried that he too would give up, but he had continued to serve for another 5 years.
"If only Dara could be here now," thought Orak.
Her resolve was failing, and she wanted to go home. Home, she realized, was no longer Northern Ireland, but Sultan Lefen of all places, somewhere she felt safe, among the few remaining people that she liked and trusted. Rory arrived at the old church, with a rather weary-looking Spike at his side.
"I tossed a coin," he told Jackman. "You can guess who won from the look on his face."
"He'll be even more unhappy when he sees what we've got for you tonight," said Jackman dourly. He took Rory aside. "In all my years on the Force, I've never seen anything like this. It's horrible."
"We had the brief before we left. I must say, you seem to have excelled yourself this time. A triple tragedy."
"But why hang them all by one foot?" said Jackman. "It's bizarre."
Rory shrugged. "Dear Jackman, you should know by now that a deranged mind is capable of all manner of monstrous acts. Good Lord, you've seen one or two right blinders yourself in the past."
"True, but it didn't make this one any easier."
"Okay, we'll go and take a look for ourselves," said Rory. "Come, Spike, gird your loins and we'll sally forth."
As he passed, Spike muttered,
"He doesn't get any better, Detective Inspector."
Jackman smiled.
"You'd have it no other way. None of us would."
He decided that they could deal with this one by themselves. After all, he told himself, a narrow spiral staircase and a chamber full of decomposing human material didn't offer too much space to maneuver. He'd just be in the way, wouldn't he? Fortunately, Marie didn't notice his sheepish expression.
"Nice lads, brothers, Jimmy and Huey Cook. They are happy to accept any help on offer. That ghastly sight in the bellringer's chamber has shaken them rigid, and I think that seeing the effect it had on Callie has upset them even more. The older one, Jimmy, says it's his fault for talking her into coming out. He says he should have known it was too soon after her scare at that old hotel, and then hearing about what happened there the following night."
"Well, I doubt he dragged her out kicking and screaming. They're a feisty bunch, these Urbexes. She'd probably have gone out anyway."
Jackman knew all about guilt trips.
"Hindsight is a wonderful thing, Marie. Shame we don't have it when we make the decisions in the first place."
Marie leaned back against the car.
"When Callie came to the station, I really believed she intended to back off for a while. Frankly, I'm very surprised that she came out again so soon. She seemed too sensible."
"I think this exploring game is addictive," said Jackman. "I googled some of the sites yesterday evening. Some of the photography is stunning. Something like that can get into your blood."
"The lads were saying much the same," said Marie. "When you find what you suspect is a new untouched site, you just have to go and look, and you want to be the first. There's quite a bit of kudos attached to the finding of somewhere hitherto unexplored." She yawned.
"Stella North is the person to talk about urban exploration, boss. She's about to release a comprehensive catalogue of amazing photographs of abandoned buildings. If there's such a thing as an expert, she's it."
"I'd like to talk to her anyway, Marie. I'm hoping she might be able to shed some light on the motive for this."
Jackman extended a hand to the church.
"But first thing tomorrow, I'm going to need you to bring me up to speed on it all."
"I'll let Robbie give you the sit-rep, boss. I gave him the lead on this, so he'd probably appreciate it if I let him present you with a full report."
She looked at her watch. "Nearly 3:30. I'll ring him at 6. He needs to know about this before he gets to the station. It's his baby, after all." Jackman agreed, full of affection for Marie and the team. There was no rivalry amongst them, which was rare.
This job could be shitty enough without internal bickering and point scoring. "You can get away if you want, Marie, and grab a couple of hours shut-eye. I'll stay here until everything is in place, then I'll try to do the same."
"Sounds like a plan, if you're okay with it. I've done all I can with the Cook brothers. They'll be coming into the station around lunchtime to give their statements."
"Just drive carefully on these roads, Marie. I know how good you are on that bloody great bike, but even so, if a mist comes down out of nowhere, some of our best traffic cops can be caught out."
"Jackman, relax. I'm totally aware of the dangers, and in future, I'd appreciate it if you didn't call my beautiful tiger a bloody great bike, okay?"
He held up his hands, laughing.
"Please convey my apologies to Tiger."
"I should think so, too,"
she grinned back. I'm going home for a boiling hot bath, with some of the sweetest-smelling bath oils I can find.
I can still smell that loft. I just feel for Rory and Spike, having to deal with all that. Even they must be struggling with this one.
They wouldn't be human if they weren't. Now, get on your beautiful tiger and go. A few minutes later, he heard the low growl of Tiger's engine. All he needed now was a report from Rory, and he could go home himself. Once the whole place had been secured, and fire and rescue knew what was expected of them, it would be over to forensics in uniform. Surely somewhere within this disaster zone, they would find some trace of the killer. Jackman went back towards the tower.
I would have thought that after all this time, I'd be used to seeing death in whatever form it took.
Spike seemed to be talking to himself. Gazing up at the three suspended bodies, Rory said,
You'll never get used to it, dear boy,
and the day you do is the day we part company, because then you will have lost your humanity.
It takes a very special person to do this job, he mused.
He needs the ability to look objectively at a person who, until just recently, was no different to yourself, someone with the same hopes and dreams. He must be able to cope with terrible damage to what was once a living, breathing human being, and be detached enough to use your skills to understand what has happened to them. Yet you must still be able to feel compassion for both them and their loved ones. It's no easy task, dear Spike.
Then I'm not being weak when I say that this, he pointed upwards, is almost too much to cope with.
Not in the slightest, my young friend. But consider this. They aren't objects of disgust or horror. They're three victims who've been treated terribly by an insane mind, and we are all they have right now.
He looked earnestly at Spike.
Only we can help both them and those who will grieve for them. We bear a big responsibility on our shoulders, but we're also in a privileged position. We have it in our power to provide the police with answers that will lead to whoever did this being locked away, hopefully, forever. He smiled gently at Spike.
It might not feel like it right now, lad, but you're special. You will perform this unpleasant task like the professional that you are.
Put it like that. Maybe we should pull our fingers out and get them down. And please, no more sermons, Reverend Wilkinson, or I'll be shouting hallelujah and falling on my knees.
Rory cast a dubious glance at the stinking mess beneath the suspended bodies.
Not something I'd recommend, considering the state of this floor, he grimaced behind his mask. But now we've got that over with, I'll go and tell the unusually absent Detective Inspector Jackman that we are ready for some ladders and some muscle to get these poor souls back on terra firma.
Rory went back down the stairs, relieved that he had chosen Spike and not his other assistant, Cardiff Erin, for this job. He had cheated when flipping that coin.
He wasn't being sexist. After all, Erin was as professional as they come.
And he had no doubt that she would have coped equally as well as Spike. But even so, Rory had wanted to spare her this one. She had not been working in forensics as long as Spike. She'd already had a lot of bad cases to deal with, and he didn't want to overload her too soon. She was worth holding on to. Once they were back in the mortuary, she would be working with him on the bodies, which would be fine, but at least he'd spared her the sight of them in situ. He would have done the same for Spike if his and Cardiff's roles had been reversed. He stepped outside, pulled off his mask, took a lungful of night air, and saw Jackman walking purposefully towards him. The poor detective looked almost anguished.
Time to lighten things up a little.
Another one like this, dear Jackman, and I'm asking for a transfer to Midsummer. It's quieter there.
I can't argue with you there, Prof, sorry.
Apology accepted, but do try to keep your deaths to one at a time. Sending them in bulk does rather overload the mortuary tables, he exhaled. But on a serious note, that was not the nicest of crime scenes, was it? Our dear Spike needed one of my famous calls to arms in order to get him back into work mode.
Oh, you bored him into getting back to work, did you? Jackman was looking more relaxed.
It was inspirational, I'll have you know. I stirred his inner pathologist.
Of course. Jackman looked at him hopefully. Any thoughts on the hanging by one foot thing, Rory?
Not really. Not yet. Rory puffed out his cheeks. Although, I can see you're not the sort of man who regularly enjoys having his fortune told. But have you ever looked at a pack of tarot cards?
No. Jackman looked puzzled.
Then do. Check them out on Google,
and take a look at the one in the Major Arcana entitled The Hanged Man, and tell me what you think.
Arcana, what's that?
Rory shook his head.
Don't worry about it. When you have a moment, just look at the picture.
Right now, however, we'd like to request some help to release our three victims from that tower.
I'll get it sorted straight away, Rory, Jackman said. The fire crew are already awaiting instruction, and then I'm getting away. Uniform will assist you in any way you need. And I'm really sorry about this one. It's affected everyone badly.
You don't need one of my inspirational homilies, do you? Because I'd be very happy.
Jackman held up his hand, grinning. No, I'm fine. Really.
Ah, well, you're lost, detective.
Rory watched in amusement as Jackman almost ran to where the fire chief and his crews were waiting. It was encouraging, but also worrying that Jackman and Marie still felt so deeply about the horrors they had to confront. He supposed they all became hardened to a certain extent, but sometimes he did wonder how much people could take before something snapped. Rory shook himself. Now was not the time to indulge in introspection. The fire chief was already shouting orders, and men and women were bringing equipment from the appliances. Getting the bodies down would be no easy task, and he wanted his new charges to be treated with as much respect and care as possible. Hearing the blare of sirens, he looked out of his window. This was no minor incident. From his vantage point close to the station, he saw vehicle after vehicle leave the car park and head out of town. He grabbed his car keys and ran to his car, making sure to keep well within the speed limit. He followed the blue lights out into the fens. He had to know where they were heading. His fears were soon realized. As soon as they turned into the familiar back road, he stopped and turned back towards town. This was only a setback, he told himself. Unfortunate, but there it was. Life threw you curveballs. After all, that was what this whole thing was about, wasn't it? He'd been thrown the biggest curveball ever, and he was dealing with it. He practiced his deep breathing, in, hold, breathe out. He wondered how they'd found the place so quickly. Another damned explorer, most likely. Places like that attracted the idiots like a magnet. No matter. His second storage facility was equally as suitable, so nothing had been lost. Breathe in. Breathe out. Tomorrow, he'd write to his wife. She deserved to know the truth. He rehearsed what he might say in his head. Dearest Helen, it is with great sadness, no, too formal. Dear Helen, do hope you're keeping well. Oh, please. Helen, you need to know the truth, no matter how painful. Ah, that was more like it. He opened his eyes. He'd write it now. And then it was done. He'd posted when the whole thing was over.